Late as it was, he was busy at work. His surgery was a table and chair in the forecourt of a large gas station. His light came from a decrepit gasoline pump. He was dirty looking for a dentist. I discovered that during the day he went from house to house buying up all unwanted dentures. In the evening, he came along and set up his primitive surgery at the gas station. The only instrument this dentist had was a pair of pliers. With these pliers, he yanked out the teeth of his Indian patients. There was no fuss, no bother, no office, no waiting room, no laboratory. Just the man, his pliers, his table and his chair. This dentist did not believe in anesthetics either. Sometimes, he did give a patient a swig from a bottle of Agadianti, which he kept on the table by his elbow. Agadianti is 98% pure sugarcane alcohol, so perhaps he intended the drink to be used for both antiseptic and analgesic purposes. If a patient needed dentures, then he had the choice of the dentist's second-hand collection. It did not matter if the poor fellow had just had an extraction. The dentist rummaged among his stock, found a plate with the requisite number of teeth on it, thrust it into his patient's mouth, and told the fellow to bite hard, even though his gums were still bleeding. You could hear him yell with triumph as he found the right plate and rammed it home. "That plate will last forever," he announced, the wording never varying. "It will never come out. Off you go, and buy yourself a bottle of Agadianti on your way home." The dentist ended this exhortation with a great belly laugh, in which his patient nearly always joined. As I say, the South Americans are, basically, a very happy people. Chapter 5. Lima. When I first began to tell about the rather uncomfortable pains of my kidney illness, it was not my intention to bother my readers with a medical history. There is hardly a life without sickness, and if every one of us would start writing about it, there would be no end to it. However, the following pages, I hope, will show my patient friends the reason behind all this. I have to explain that at the beginning of the year 1967, after an endless and miserable flight over the snow-covered Andes Mountains from Iquitos to Lima, the doctors of the Maison Francaise Hospital in Lima ordered an operation. I went through the usual routine of checks, tests and X-ray pictures. The trouble was located in my right kidney. My doctor explained things to me, and I agreed to have the operation as soon as possible. I was allocated a very nice room with a private bath on the ground floor of the hospital. An inner door led to an antechamber which gave on to the patio garden, which is a characteristic feature of Latin American architecture, and shows the Spanish influence that persists in Peru. My quarters were, indeed, very comfortable. I thought that, if I was doomed to die under the knife, then at least I would die in pleasant surroundings. A friendly sister of Spanish origin took charge of me. At first, it was rather a silent friendship, for after all the tests I felt really wretched once more. However, as the pain subsided, a warm relationship developed between us. Sister Marta, for that was her name, told me all about her work, and the history of this famous hospital. She also told me about her nostalgia for Spain. Strangely, the climate of Peru did not agree with her, and she longed to get back to Europe. I was told that I would have my operation some 3 days after I had been admitted to the Maison Francaise Hospital. I would have liked to have had it right away, but there was little I could do to change the operating theater timetable. So I resigned myself to putting up with the intermittent pain for another couple of days, and sweat it out in the very pleasantly decorated room. When I say sweat it out, I really mean what I say. In the months of January and February 1967, Lima was enjoying a heat wave, and in the tropics that means that it is very hot indeed. I kept the windows and the door to the patio open in order to obtain the greatest advantage from what little breeze there was. On the second night that I spent in Maison Francaise, I had a very severe bout of pain. So strong was this agony of mine, that with the pain and the heat of the night, I felt that death would be a welcome relief. I tried to reach the bell push by the side of my bed. My intention was to summon the night nurse and ask her to give me some pain-killing injection. Automatically, I registered the time by my bedside clock. It was almost 3 in the morning. My groping fingers failed to find the bell push that would summon help and relief. But I did find something else, a hand that came from the pain-racked night and clasped my own. Tormented by pain as I was, I still felt a shock when I found my hand grasped by another slim, warm one. A tiny beam of light pierced the dark. I could make out the features of my nocturnal visitor. It was Xity, Satura's sister. Without a word, she smiled at me, took off the ring and put one of those healing tablets in my mouth. Quickly, I looked at the ring she had taken. The metal inset, inserted in the band of gold, glowed with its warning light. Because of the tremendous pain, I had not felt the burning rays from my ring. The red-haired Austrian had given me hope that the Etibiray ions were still on our own planet. Now here she was at my bedside, as if in answer to my prayers. How she had known that I was sick, how she had known where to find me, I did not know. All I was conscious of was her nearness, the sense of utter relief that engulfed me as she sat down on my bed, and the thought that now she was with me, to take from me the horrible pain. A faint light reflected from the jewel talking device that I had last seen in Ben Ayres. Still without speaking, Xity stretched out her hands to me. Her sensitive fingers, from which she had removed the protective fingertip gloves, ran lightly over my face with gossamer touch. I did not know how long she had been in the room before she revealed her presence. I do not know how long her healing fingers soothed my sweating, fevered face. But I do know that what with her ministrations and the swift effect of the tablet, the pain eased from my body and I wallowed in the peace. I was free of pain. Even the fever left me. In that moment, I took Xity into my arms, inhaling the sweet strangeness of her lovely body. Because of the closeness of our embrace, Xity, hiding her mouth behind a minute veil of silk, I later found out that they used this in order to avoid infection, struggled to free herself, pouring broken little melodic nothings into my receptive ears. Xity stayed with me. We saw dawn come grey rose, saw the Catholic sisters make their way to chapel, heard their singing to welcome the new tropical day. It was then that I asked her the question that had been bothering me. How did she know I was in South America, in Lima, in this hospital? She told me about a nurse called Maria Navidad she wanted to see, but had hesitated to do so because of several problems involved. It so happened that this was the young lady rescued by the mestizos and the Austrian guide near the town of Pucallpo on the Ucayali River, rescued as a baby and raised as an orphan by the sisters. We knew her mother, Xity informed me, and what she told me is almost impossible to believe. The mother of the baby had been terribly beaten. Near death, the Indian woman had been rescued by the out-of-space biologists, having found her near their first landing site. After healing the Indian woman, she was taken to Itibiratu, where she died soon after. She could not adjust herself to the different planet and yet had not wanted to return to Earth. So great her fear had been. But, as Xity later informed me, she died the way all Itibirayans die, in peace and happiness. The mother of Maria Navidad must have been some kind of a celebrity on that planet, and the humanistic people had wanted to know as much about the former life she had led on Earth and in particular about the baby, that Xity asked me to talk to Maria Navidad as she hesitated to do so herself. As I considered myself a very sick man, I told Xity about the coming operation, but she smiled softly and said, "You shall be free of pain for 6 of your months." And right she was. All this may be checked by any one of my readers. I became the miracle patient of the famous Maison Francaise Hospital in Lima, Peru. When the doctors came around to put me on the operating table, I had already eaten a very heavy breakfast, a thing I had not done for almost 3 weeks. I had gotten out of bed, a new man in need of a hot and cold bath. Feeling perfectly well, I had ventured outside and eaten in one of the little Chinese coffee shops, the chifas, as they are called in Ecuador, Bolivia and Peru. Xity was right. I was able to report that I had not so much as a single twinge of pain, nor, although I was not to know it at that time, Despite Xitier's optimism, did I have any symptoms of kidney trouble for almost exactly the time she had indicated? I never enjoyed such good health as I experienced during the ensuing year, without so much as a cold, a headache, toothache, or any other ache or pain to which man is heir. You should have seen the raised eyebrows, the looks of disbelief among the medical people when, instead of being wheeled into the operating theatre, I told them I was going to discharge myself as cured. They could tell just by looking at me that I was infinitely better, and although they agreed to postpone the operation, they insisted that I should remain in the hospital at least until the next day in order to make another series of exhaustive tests, and also to ensure themselves that I did not have a relapse. This I agreed to do, for I had to kill time for a day until an appointment I had with Xity, to be at the Sky Room of the Hotel Grillen. For the rest of the day I submitted myself to all the tests and checks that the doctors could devise. They were all negative. The Catholic sisters were ready to believe in a miracle. The doctors continued to raise their eyebrows. Well, said a puzzled surgeon. You're as fit as a flea. Then I can be discharged tomorrow morning, I said. I see no reason why not. I shall be grateful then if you would arrange it. Certainly. This really is baffling, the doctor said again. Yesterday you were a very sick man, and today you seem to be a different person. I must have been visited by an angel during the night, I replied, making a feeble joke. You must have been, he agreed, looking at me sharply. But my face gave nothing away, and he left me in order to make the necessary arrangements for my discharge from hospital. Sister Marta was much more positive when she came back to my room. The saints be praised, she announced. A very miracle if ever I've seen one. Whatever it is, I am profoundly thankful, I told her. Not that I am ungrateful for what you've done for me. I really felt very ill when I arrived here. You were, she affirmed. Sister Marta, I asked, do you know a colleague of yours who works in this hospital? Sister Maria Navidad? Indeed I do. Not a nursing sister, you understand. She finished her finals at the beginning of this year. She is over in Men's Medical. Sister Marta favored me with a very shrewd look. Do you think I could have a word with her? Please. I returned it as blandly as I could. Very well. I will see to it. She was as good as her word. I was sitting on the patio after lunch, luxuriating in the hot sunshine, when a young nurse, who could hardly have been more than 20, came up to my patio bench. Good afternoon, she began. Sister Marta informs me you wanted to see me. Indeed I do, nurse, I replied in Spanish, getting to my feet. Forgive my taking this very personal interest in you, but I would like to take some pictures of you and Sister Marta before I have to go. Naturally, good-natured as all the Latins are, she agreed and even smiled together with Sister Marta as I took the photos. Neither Sister Marta nor Maria Navidad could possibly understand this sudden interest, but when Sister Marta left the palio I immediately turned to Maria Navidad and told her about the Austrian guide and how I was informed about the rescue of a tiny little baby so many years ago. I wanted to make her talk, to hear her version of all this, but the young lady did not say a word. She just stood there as struck by thunder and suddenly, after I had said something about having heard from other people about her mother, I saw two tiny little pearls, the tears of a motherless child, running down her cheeks. I felt deeply ashamed. At 10 a.m. the following morning, I paid my hospital bill, said goodbye to Sister Marta, caught a taxi, and checked in at the Hotel Crillon. There were no vacancies, so I had to content myself by making a reservation for the earliest possible time, and took myself to the Savoy, where I was given a room on the 10th floor. I unpacked, strolled onto the balcony, and admired the view. It was a stupendous, panoramic view of most of Lima, a magnificent kaleidoscope that stretched as far as the eye could see to the protecting hills of Chosica. I was on top of the world again and in more senses than one. I have always liked to let things simmer before making new decisions, and I therefore decided not to go to my office. Instead, I went to the movies, had a good dinner and, As soon as the clock struck 12 at night, I left my room and made my way to the Krillan nearby. The laggard lift delayed my entrance to the Sky Room, where an orchestra was playing Mexican melodies. City had arrived before me, and this surprised me very much, as a decent young lady wouldn't venture into a nightclub unaccompanied, even though the nightclub of the Sky Room at the Hotel Krillan is to be considered as one of the best, if not the very best, in all Peru. Sure enough, there were suspicious and curious glances from well-dressed people nearby. Immediately, and because of the minute blue veil she wore, people noticed the subtle difference between her and ourselves, our people, from our planet. By this, I mean not just cultured Peruvians, or the many Europeans and North Americans staying at this famous first-class hotel, but even the less instructed bellboys and lift operators, stared at City. But, instead of finding her embarrassed or shy, she looked at me and everybody with the greatest of ease. I ordered a Tom Collins for her and had a double scotch, which made me ask her to dance. I am old-fashioned enough to think that our nervous system, on which we depend so much for our erotic titillation, cannot be unknown territory to those from another world. I found this to be correct, and particularly correct with the soft music and the wonderful theme song of Pedro Infante, Amorcito Corazon. Outside the Sky Room window, millions of lights, the lights of a fairyland Lima, the lights of Lima by night, which is a different light to the daylight of the endless slums, the lights of human illusions, were blazing and glittering while the music was playing. An unforgettable evening, and I left her, floating on air. During the next few days, I was able to find out many things concerning the precautionary measures protecting City. It is an interesting fact that City's feeling of security is connected with the kindness and superior intelligence of these people. Their belief that no human being on Earth can really harm them because of what she called Amatmena, or their science of soul, we do not understand. They are able to read our very thoughts, and not only are they able to take their precautions but may be able to influence our thoughts should this be necessary because of security reasons. It is evident that I was very curious about this. When I asked her about it, she did not want to explain, and only much later was I able to get the details about their precautionary measures. For 2 days I had the pleasure of wandering through public and private libraries, museums, an English club, churches, shops, supermarkets, up and down the famous Calder La Union. As we could not speak to each other while in public, we appraised everything by the touch of our hands or little gestures. Because of the wonderful physical and mental well-being after days and weeks of pain, I looked upon this short time I spent with City as the happiest couple of days in my entire life. A period of convalescence. Perhaps this was all due to the life-saving tablet she had given me. If I come to think of it, my mental clairvoyance during these days was simply extraordinary. It was the first time that I understood the way these people feel about time. I really understood how they feel about life. You see, we human beings think of life as a period, where we have to hurry things. To our friends from out of space, this looks as if we are afraid of life itself. As if life was the worst part of our destiny, as if it were a great misfortune. Of course, as so many people still suffer on our planet, how can this be considered otherwise? But being with City, I suddenly began to see things their way, relaxed, they are, and perhaps more than relaxed. They are just infallibly considerate to everything. City's interest, for instance, in music was something wonderful to experience. At the entrance of the Calder La Union in Lima there is a record shop. Already, passing the Hotel Bolivar on the Placo de San Martin, City's acoustic nerves had taken up the rhythm of this shop's loudspeaker playing some Colombian cumbias. She really liked that, and there is reason to suppose that it would have been no better, or let us say cultured, if she had listened to Beethoven instead. She simply liked the rhythm of cumbia. Seldom have I seen a happier look on someone's face as this strange woman passed the record store. How many people on our earth, I thought, are able to enjoy the forces of rhythm as much as City did? At the time in Lima, I did not know that I would soon be able to experience the great sensitive activities of these people, that I would hear about their work, their beneficial and health-restoring religion, their very life and death. The highly abnormal circumstances into which I was drawn were never exhausting. As a matter of fact, they were agreeable to my health. I simply liked to be with Xity, and when she asked me if I would want to meet her brother, I was very pleased to accept her invitation. Even though quite a few adventurers and not too well-dressed Indian natives are still trading in gold, like in the old Western times, in Bolivia, Ecuador and Peru, the beautifully melted and carved ingots surprised the specialists. On the 17th of February 1967, the week of the summer zenith of the Peruvian year, we left Lima at 7:45. Loaded with packages and suitcases crammed full of books, records, seeds, and God knows what else that Xity had bought, our train journey was to take us over the highest railroad pass which has ever been constructed. Chapter 6. Through the Front Door of Hell. On the 17th of February 1967, the week of the summer zenith of the Peruvian year, we left Lima at 7:45. Loaded with packages and suitcases crammed full of books, records, seeds, and God knows what else that Xity had bought, our train journey was to take us over the highest railroad pass which has ever been constructed. Thousands of feet up the majestic Andes Mountains. From the steaming hot coastal plains of Peru, the train was to take us through the River of Evil Valleys, as the Indians call it, to the very front door of Amazonic Hell, Huancayo, surrounded by snow-covered hills, see picture below, the last outposts of semi-civilized wilderness. The train pulled out of Central Station right on the button. We had two first-class window seats to ourselves. The green livery of the train made a splendid splash of color as the engine headed its way towards the high mountains. Of course, the ubiquitous British had built this railway. Wherever you go in the world, in the most unlikely and inaccessible places, you are almost sure to come across a British-built railway. They must have had a mania for building railways, and as their own small island did not give them much scope for laying out routes on the grand scale, they moved into other territories, either by conquest or by invitation, and built their railways. Here are general videos on this railway journey magnificently. I doubt if any other people, except perhaps the Americans, could have built a line to compare with those that wormed their way up to the Andean roof of the world. Naturally, the British expect to benefit from all this railway building. Passenger traffic alone would not be much of a recompense. Here in the Andes, as in other places where the British have left their mark, the hills and mountains are bulging with mineral wealth waiting to be mined and shifted to the industrial powers of the world. In the particular case of the Andes, the mineral is chiefly copper. The journey is most thrilling, even for the most hardened of travelers. It is not a fast run, for the line is so tortuous. Xity and I were happy to watch the scenic splendor of the trip up into the high mountains. The River Rimac is the first major hazard out of Lima. Frail bridges take the line over this curving river, which races crazily far below. The railway then threads its way through steep canyons, pierced by hundreds of mephitic tunnels, beyond each of which is another breathtaking view. Nearer and nearer chugs the train to the cruel peaks of the Ayo Mountains. Round about 11 we pulled into less than Machu Cana. Even before the train had stopped, the carriages were besieged by hundreds of pitiful, barefooted sellers of corn cob, tortillas, and soft drinks, who importuned the passengers, as did the countless children, who came shouting, pushing and poking their way through the sellers and beggars. Innumerable dogs also came to see what they could scavenge from the train. Machu Cana is the last stop before the train enters the towering highland region. It is also the last stop where tropical fruit can be bought, and the last place to see happy faces. Thereafter, life in the Andean highlands is grim and earnest. The line climbed for another 5,000 feet, and the train clickety-clicked its way into the sky. We were now in the land of the stoical, melancholic and ever distrustful Indians. This is the land where the Spanish conqueror, Francisco Pizarro, went out of his mind. The land is cold, wild and windy. The barren terrain stretched endlessly. The few towns in the area, La Union, Junin and Huancayo, are unfriendly and pathetic. We had booked two tickets to Huancayo Air, Soak City informed me, Satura would be waiting with transport. I did not ask her how she had communicated with her brother. I took it for granted that if they wanted to do something, they would do it, even though an ordinary mortal such as myself might have difficulty in accomplishing what was to be done. Shortly after 4 o'clock that afternoon, we arrived at Huancayo. I found it to be a fair-sized Indian mountain town, round about the 13,000-foot contour. The roads are often impassable because of snow or a sudden cloudburst. Surrounding narrow canyons, the steep peaks of the Andes, dilapidated mud huts, giant cacti, all these give the place an almost surrealistic air. The marvel is that the railway could reach this spot. At the station we were met by Mr. Satura, whom I did not recognize at first. He was dressed very much like the natives, with heavy woolen gear. There wasn't much difference to be noticed between his looks and the taxi driver who he had charged with helping to unload all our luggage. We had a brief word of greeting, and then we busied ourselves pushing all the impedimentic city had discovered in the Peruvian capital into the car. Never, in all my life, have I seen such a vehicle. No fenders, and with broken back windows. The old Buick also had no hood and the motor could be observed in full operational vigor. We were much amused by this and as soon as we were on the road, the old Buick surprised us with one of the finest radios to which I have ever listened. The car described was probably even more a wreckage than this Buick. Soon after leaving Huancayo, we passed some Inc ruins. These were the first I had seen, and Satura kindly stopped the car in order that we might take a closer look at the ruins. The Incas, as we have all learned, have left many well-preserved settlements. At this particular site there were also the ruins of a fortress. Satura had evidently visited this before, and he told me some interesting facts about it, and also showed me the secret entrance to what must have been the royal treasure chamber. Night comes early in the Peruvian mountains, so we could not stay too long exploring the ruins. We had to carry on with our drive. Just as dusk was falling, we came to a trail that led down to a huge lake. It might have been part of Lake Junin or some other of the many Lagos del Altiplano that littered the way to La Union. As soon as we stopped and unloaded the car, the taxi driver said adios and wanted to kiss the hands of Mr. Satura, something absolutely out of the question in Peru. It surprised me very much and, I believe that Satura must have helped this man or some sick member of his family. I was never told, nor have I ever seen this man again. After we saw his unfortunate vehicle disappear, we enjoyed the very peaceful lakeside. With the snow-covered Andes peaks in the background, we observed the setting sun, coloring the white of the mountain with pure gold. A great feeling of happiness came over me. There was also an Indian shepherd with many beautiful big and fat sheep. Instead of being fascinated by the sunset, he was fascinated by us. I shall never forget this shepherd. Thinking about it today, I still have to laugh. You see, at the very moment the sun had disappeared, I saw my first flying saucer and at the same time as it settled down gracefully and easily on the surface of the lake, I saw the shepherd disappear with the speed of a hunted rabbit. In spite of my being filled with a terrific sensation of awe, I just could not help laughing at the Indian's dashing velocity. There was a soft but painful noise, or rather reverberation, as the saucer glided towards the edge of the lake, right to the spot where we were waiting. It was then when I thought I could not bear it any longer and that the whole valley, with its lakes and hills would be ripped to pieces. As the noise disappeared, a few decibels from painful to bearable, the saucer hovered, and opened up underneath its circular surface. Like a giant crooking his little finger, an embarkation device, soft and gripping at the same time, scooped us up and deposited us in some kind of antiseptic reception quarter. Immediately I became aware of the biological, vegetational, cellular structure, similar to soft polyethylene, embellished with exquisite designs and symbols. Only the flooring was a little harder, and I suppose the reason for this must be its mirror-like quality. Through this floor, you could see like a surgeon would be able to see your brain.